Well, in the first meditation yesterday, we got up to chapter 6 of Mark. And I'm distinguishing with you, I've called the whole thing the portraits of Jesus. Now, assuming no photoshopping is going on, a photo, it's appropriate to ask the question, what? Like, what did people wear in 1930? And the photo will tell you, if it hasn't been manipulated. And how many people were at the wedding in that group? And you look and you think, yes. And, oh, that must have been before Aunt Mary died, because there she is. You know, those kind of practical, factual questions. When you're looking at a portrait, you don't really ask those questions, or you're going to be left in a lot of doubt about it. You're really asking a separate question, as you know, and you walk into an art gallery, you're asking, why did Van Gogh have a purple dray in the middle of the field outside Arles? Or why did the portrait of that famous Dame Mellie Melba or something, why has it got such a thin neck? I mean, what's he saying about it? You know the difference. So you're really trying to get in, because only a lover can write a gospel. Only someone who's meditated profoundly, or that picture I showed you yesterday of the beloved disciple against the breast of Jesus. It's only someone who's learnt to love and seen into and come to know what the eye doesn't see and the ear doesn't hear, but the heart knows and is moved by. So you're talking about, in Mark's gospel, Peter's portrait of Jesus, based, of course, on what Jesus said and what Jesus did. They're not improving on him or fanciful. They're looking to get to the real Jesus, but the real Jesus that they got to know moment by moment, experience by experience, and then in the light of the death and resurrection of Jesus and 30 years of experience in the early church and seeing this extraordinary explosion of Christianity through Greece and Macedonia and over a bit to the east and then to Rome, and it was catching on like a fire. We know why. It was about love. So they're portraying Jesus as the one who gave us the good news, lived it. And so how do you do that? How do you portray that in an Antioch place, or in this case, in this gospel, in Rome? How do you do it in Alexandria? How do you communicate in an effective way? So you're building up, I hope, a little bit yesterday and some in your questions in your mind. And then now, how do you do Mark's gospel in 2 hours? Well, I'm about to show you, but very imperfectly. We've seen Jesus as the herald of the good news about God. And surely we've seen that God is one who is moved with compassion for the broken and the outsider and the people who are mentally disturbed. Everyone, in fact. He's revealed that God is actually love and embraces lepers, not as God was portrayed in Leviticus chapter 13, as outcasting them. It's quite a big change, really. No wonder it's called news. We've seen Jesus as the one who calls on us, because it's free, love is never imposed, calls on us to believe, to be in love, to open ourselves to the love. Because if we don't, as we saw yesterday in those scenes, these powerful scenes of the external chaos cannot separate us from God's love. Internal chaos can't separate us. Death can't separate us. But there's something that can. Not because God is stopping loving, because God never stops, but because Jesus was amazed at their lack of belief. He could work no miracle in Nazareth because they didn't believe. They didn't see a sign. They weren't open to the mystery. We see Jesus as a light in the dark and a liberating and healing God. So let us now move to the second part of the gospel. We're still in chapter 6, And in this hour, I propose to get right through to chapter 16, so you'll excuse me if I select a lot, but I'm trying to get the essence of it briefly. The apostles gathered around Jesus and told him all they'd done and taught. They'd gone on their first mission, and I don't know what they've told him, because we're not told, but whatever they told him, he says to them, and notice Mark, I've made the translation myself, but he keeps shifting from the past, which it's about, but then he brings the present tense in, which is dramatically appropriate. It's happening right now. He says to them, come away to a deserted place all by yourselves and rest a while. For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. And they went away in a boat to a deserted place by themselves. Now, many saw them going and recognized them, and they hurried there on foot from all the towns and arrived ahead of them. And Jesus went ashore and saw this great crowd. You know what Jesus' plan was, we've just been told. But here, as in our mission and life often enough, they turn the corner in the boat, expecting a lovely little quiet beach and a few palm trees, and I don't know what, and just general. And there's a whole bloody crowd of people. And Jesus says, he's moved with compassion. So whatever initial feeling he may have had of disappointment, I'm only guessing, I don't know, but it moved quickly to compassion. Because they're like sheep without a shepherd, a statement taken from the book of Numbers where Moses sees the people in the same way. The literature is full of the music of the Old Testament. That's their literature, that's their world. So, and he began to teach them many things. We've had that so often in the Gospel of Mark. Jesus the teacher, enlightening the mind, because metanoia or repentance means changing your way of looking at things. How can you, unless somebody gives you an idea that gets in and helps you readjust your frames of reference? When it grew late, you know this scene real well, but I'm just trying to take you through it. His disciples came to Jesus and said, this is a deserted place, and the hour is now very late. Send them away. That's a reasonable thing to say. Send them away so that they can go into the surrounding village and buy themselves something to eat. And here comes the key line in the whole passage, which, don't miss it. You give them something to eat yourselves. A lovely 97 or something year old woman in Randwick, who's died a few years ago now at that age, said to me that she was told by a priest in Randwick, came from Randwick, one of our MSC priests said to her one day as a young woman, because she lost her husband quite young and had three children, two of whom became religious sisters, by the way, in the Allied Sacred Heart Order. The priest said to her, Norma, she said, when people ask you to do something, they want you to do it. And that stayed with her all her life. And I don't ever remember seeing her being asked, we can always do something, you know, we can refer people, so we should. But here's Jesus saying to the apostles who've just come back from their mission and they're practical and they're this, you give them something to eat, you do it. That's what mission's about, you do it. And their answer is perfectly logical, and it would be mine too. How are we going to buy 200 days' wages worth of bread to give it to them to eat? I mean, they haven't got the money, they haven't got the resources, they can't possibly do it. And you've had that reaction to when you've been asked to do something, I bet. So Jesus says, okay, well, look, how many loaves have you got? What resources do you have? What gifts do you have? What's God given you to give? And they go out and find out, and they clinch the argument. It's all over now. Jesus has got nothing more to say. He said, well, look, we've got 5 loaves and 2 fish. And they look at their watches or whatever they had of the equivalent and said, look, for God's sake, it's getting later and later. If you don't go, the shops will be closed and they'll get nothing at all to eat. Come on, Jesus. You be practical, you know. And look what he does. He ordered them to get all the people to sit down in groups on the green grass. They sat down in groups of hundreds and fifties. And we go back to the book of Exodus and we find that was the kind of, I suppose you'd call it, like a military organization to protect people against the nomads and the Amalekites and whoever in the desert, journey on the desert. So that's how they used to. So he's reenacting dramatically scenes from the Exodus, from the journey through the desert when they were hungry too, when the crowd was hungry. And then look at the right-hand side, but don't focus on it because that's actually the Last Supper account of Mark. The red is the part we're reading, and you'll see an identical frame. You can't possibly, there must be a literary connection between them, but I'll read the left-hand side. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, Jesus looked up to heaven, blessed, that is, he praised God, broke the loaves and gave them to his disciples to set before the people. Okay, I don't know that you know Greek, so I'll take it you don't. These are all aorist, or that's an aorist participle. Looked up to heaven, blessed, broke, are straight aorist, preterite, you might call it in some of your languages. They're past actions. This bit here is not the aorist. It's called the imperfect tense. It's the form of the past where you enter into the middle of something. It's not saying what happened, it's saying what was happening when something else happened. You got it? That's the purpose of this change. Why the translators here didn't bring it out, I haven't the faintest idea, but they should have said, he broke the loaves and continued to give them, or was giving them to his disciples, to set before the people. The point of that distinction is, if you've seen films by Cecil B. DeMille or somebody else, I can't remember, but I've seen something like that, and they have a basket, and it goes up to Jesus, and he does what he does, and then Andrew or somebody carries this basket, and suddenly, fish and bread comes pouring out of the basket. Well, that's not what it says. It says that Andrew or somebody came up to Jesus with 5 loaves and 2 fish. It's not much. Jesus broke it. Because we're talking about the broken heart and body of Jesus here. He broke it. Life can be broken. And he gives that to Andrew, just what Andrew gave him, just like we did at Eucharist today. It's no more. There's no more bread there or wine there after the consecration. But he brings this gift up and Andrew goes back. And by the time he's finished the first row, it's gone. It's finished. It's empty. He's got none left. So what's he do? He comes back to Jesus. The miracle happens in the hands of Jesus. He is the miracle worker. He is the source of everything. So you spend your mission, Monday, and by the time Monday night comes, you're exhausted, you've got nothing else to give, and hopefully you've got a bed to sleep in, and you go to bed. And then Tuesday it starts again, or I'm not, and you're not, most of you. I don't know who's here, but I think you all look like brothers, nuns, and priests, so you probably haven't got too many kids. but if you were a parent, you'd know. You give all your parents, think of your family. You give all your love to the first kid, and the second kid comes along, you give all your love to the second one. You give all your love to the third one. You give all your love, because love isn't measured. It's not quantitative. It's just constantly begotten. So here, in the hands of Jesus, this wonderful feeding is happening. And they ate and were filled. And they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces and fish, for obvious reasons. 12, there's 12 apostles, eh? This is the mission. And 12, everything, every time you meet apostle in the New Testament, it means you, it means everybody. Don't let the bishops pinch it. I mean, it is, the bishops have a role in it, obviously, but they don't. When there's 12, it means the universal, it means every single Christian is involved. As soon as you see 12, it's you're in there, everyone's in there in different ways. So you've got 12 baskets. In other words, as we'll find out, do this in memory of me. You've got to take out to your mission what Jesus has just done, the broken pieces, and they'll constantly be there to be given. And then it gives us the number of the people there. I'll read a couple of Old Testament texts and then I'll come back to try and say something about that. Here's Isaiah 55. Why do you spend your money for what is not bread? Why do you labour for that which doesn't satisfy? Listen carefully to me. Eat what is good. Delight yourself in rich food. Incline your ear. Come to me. Listen so that you may live. I will make with you an everlasting covenant. That's got something to do with our sin. 2 Corinthians 9:8. God is able to provide you with every blessing in abundance, says Paul, so that by always having enough of everything, you may share abundantly in every good work. And John's, apart from me, you can do nothing. In our logically trained post-enlightenment empirical scientific world, which is a beautiful world, and we thank God for every bit of it, you probably ask, what happened there on that place? What happened? Well, I don't know. It doesn't say much, but I don't know. Just as when I look at a portrait, I'm not real sure of what was there. I'll give you an image made up a bit, but not entirely, from my own life. So I lived at Northbridge. I might paint a picture of my home for you if I was an artist. I'm not, but say I was. So I might paint a picture of my art. And I might have in the front lawn a weeping willow. And people think, oh, it's funny, I've walked along Balambi Street, Northbridge. I don't remember that house having weeping willows. In fact, I think it was a palm tree. Actually, it was a palm tree. So a person who wasn't there might know. Like, what? I wonder what kind of tree was in the front yard. Well, in a way, they're asking the wrong question. The question they should be asking is, why did Michael paint a weeping willow in that portrait? And it could be because my elder sister died of asthma and in a gutter, I have to tell you, with mum holding her. And that happened a bit later, so I've transposed it a bit for the image. But in other words, I might be trying to tell you what the house felt like to a boy who lived in it. That's all right to do, isn't it? So the question is really, what is Peter telling us about Jesus? And you can't miss the manna in the desert. You can't miss the nourishment that we all need to journey through the desert to the promised land. You haven't missed that. And you can't miss the fact that Jesus is the source of the nourishment that we need. And then you read it elsewhere in the gospel, surely Jesus says, when you go on your mission, don't take any food with you. Remember that? Don't take a haversack and don't take this and don't take that. Don't take any food with you. Does that mean you don't put an apple in your pocket because you're walking to? It doesn't got nothing to do with food. It means the food you're going to need for your journey will be given you by God. It's the nourishment of the soul we're talking about. Are you okay with this? So it's a matter of just shifting our way of looking at this wonderful literature. And all right. Well, if that's not enough to get you excited, wait for this. Immediately. And these two scenes are together in Matthew, in John, which is rare that John and the synoptics have got the same. We've got this scene about getting in a boat. And we've got to be thinking about crossing the Red Sea, and Exodus chapter 15, and the manna in the desert. But now they're turned around by Mark, by Peter, turned around, and you've got the manna in the desert coming before the crossing of the Red Sea. All right, so here we are, crossing the Red Sea with Moses. Immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go on to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd. Saying farewell to them, he went up to the mountain to pray. So here's Jesus ascended, if you like. This is the risen Christ in heaven with the Father interceding for us in prayer. When evening came, the boat was out on the sea. He was alone on the land. When he saw that they were straining at the oars against an adverse wind, you're back with Rome, Nero's persecution, the collapse of the community, you've got all that going on, so they're going against an adverse wind. He came to them early in the morning, walking on the sea. And I'll get you a moment. Psalm, Job, has God walking on the sea? Well, God doesn't walk. God hasn't got feet like a platypus or whatever. He's not walking. God doesn't walk, but that's an image. God, we've got to be able to handle that. So God walk means sea is chaos. God isn't dragged down into the chaos. God rises above the chaos. This is God we're watching when we're watching Jesus. That's the whole point of the gospel. So here is Jesus not sucked into the chaos, which you and I can be. And when we look at Matthew's gospel after the break, we're going to see a wonderful addition of Matthew to this, which brings out the meaning of it so superbly. But in here, Mark hasn't got it. He intended to pass them by, or it appeared that he was going to pass them by, because he has to be invited. He's not going to barge in. But when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost, and they cried out, for they were all terrified. But immediately, this is so powerful, he spoke to them and said, take heart, or courage, cordis, courage, it comes from the word heart. So be courageous, take heart, it is I. Now if you listen to the gospel, you were back in the year 65 or something in Rome and you heard it, you'd be reading it in Greek, and what you'd hear was, ego eimi. Now, if you hear ego eimi in Greek, and that's what the language they were speaking, and that's the language of their Bible, of the New Testament Bible, you've got to think of Moses, burning bush, who are you? And God says, ego eimi ho'on, I am the one, or I am who I am. You translate it every different way. But I am being. You can't name me, you can't put a little tag on me and say, well, you've got God fixed up. Now, what else have we got a problem with? This is as big as the cosmos and bigger, transcending everything. I am. So as soon as you hear I am, you're in a theophany. It's God. It's the sacred, the tremendous mystery that is at the heart of everything that you're contacting. Don't be afraid. Then he got into the boat with them and the wind ceased. And they were utterly astounded. For they didn't understand. Look at this. I looked at this for years, I have to tell you, before I had the chance to really study it. And I thought, they were astounded. Now, I thought they'd be astounded because he walked on the water. I mean, that seems reasonable enough. That would be enough to get me thinking, what's going on here? No, they were astounded. Their hearts were hardened. They didn't understand about the loaves. If you read the Brian, is it? Brian. Brian was showing me the non sequitur this morning. You know that thing in the Sydney Morning Herald? There's a thing there called non sequitur, which all you lateral thinkers would have a look at every now and then. Well, that looks like a non sequitur. It doesn't follow. What's the connection? I mean, lateral thinking. What's the loaves got to do with walking on water? It's not immediately obvious. Their hearts were closed. They didn't understand. In other words, they didn't understand that they won't be sucked in. You won't be sucked into the... Just as you're hungry, God will provide the food you need just for today, for the moment, for this occasion, if you trust and hope, he will do. So God will also ensure that you're not dragged down. I mean, you might drown somewhere. I mean, people drown. I presume saints have drowned. So God isn't going to come down and with your beautiful guardian angel, which you heard of this morning, which is lovely, and kind of lift you out of the water when everyone else gets drowned. What's that about? Why didn't he lift everyone out of the water? So it isn't about that, but it is about trust. And he's talking to the Roman community. You will not be... Dreadful things have happened, but take courage. God is with us. Jesus is with us. And he will ensure that we don't get sucked into the maelstrom of evil. So we've been nourished already so that we can cross the Red Sea to freedom. We're nourished so that we can cope with life, continue, nothing can stop you loving, we can continue the mission, and that trust is vital to our lives. Isaiah 43, thus says Yahweh who created you, O Jacob, he who formed you, O Israel, don't be afraid, I have redeemed you, I've called you by your name, you're mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. Surely you can see the connection. When you go through the rivers, they will not overwhelm you. That's been said beautifully by Isaiah, or rather the prophet of the exile. And here is Mark, having read that, Peter having read that, the people having read that, he gives us a New Testament portrait of that situation there with Jesus there, because Jesus is with us. Are you getting what I'm trying to get at? Yes. Jesus is with us. And if we slip into thinking, what was the photo behind the painting? Well, you're left with mystery. I don't know, and I guess you don't know. Or if you think you know, you shouldn't. Isaiah 51:10. Was it not you who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, who made the depths of the sea a way for the redeemed to cross over? When you get a scene in the New Testament that's shot full of Old Testament references, you're definitely clearly into an analogical, symbolic world. So you've got to look for a deeper meaning here. Exodus 15:19, the Israelites walked through the sea on dry ground. Psalm 77, when the waters saw you, O God, when the waters saw you, God, ego, eimi, they were afraid. The very deep trembled. Your way was through the sea, your path through the mighty waters, yet your footprints were unseen. This is poetry. God hasn't got footprints. But he does have, you know. You stretched out the heavens, you trampled the waves of the sea. That's Job. Okay. Now a bit more peaceful now. Mark chapter 8. This brings us to the end of the first part of Mark's gospel, which right at the beginning was the good news about God, about Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God. Here's the Messiah bit. Jesus went, you know it too well, I won't delay on it. Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi, and on the way he was asking his disciples, who do you say I am? Now, it's a good question because we've already seen the leaders want to destroy him, chapter 3, verse 6. His family, though we missed this because I didn't have time to do it all with you, his family tried to restrain him because they thought he was kind of mad. His hometown, we did this, was scandalized at him because he's, we know, his brothers and sisters and he's the carpenter and what the heck's he doing? And they were scandalized with him. And his disciples failed to understand him. This has all happened so far, so it's not looking too good. And Jesus says, who do people say I am? And they answered, John the Baptist, and others, Elijah, Still others, one of the prophets. Then he asks the real key question. And Mark is asking you, who do you say I am? Who am I for you? And Peter speaks up and says, you are the Christ, the Messiah. That's a beautiful statement if you put the accent in the right place. The accent is on the word you. Everybody knows what they don't. They've got a whole lot of opinions about the Messiah. It's been spoken about for a long time, expecting this, whatever, king, priest, whatever, prophet, some mysterious figure from heaven is going to be powerful and is going to get rid of the Romans and is going to... Yeah, okay, you've got a whole host of thoughts. But now Peter, through living with Jesus for whatever, 18 months and 2 years or something, we're not told exactly, but something like that, living with him, watching with him, going to sleep on the beach with him, fishing with him, walking through the fields with him, getting to know this extraordinarily simple but very beautiful lover, Jesus, he says something wonderful. He says, you are the Messiah. You. Now that's a marvelous conversion of mind. And Peter, while he has said it, he won't quite grasp it, as you'll see. He'll deny Jesus a little bit later in that talk. But it's a wonderful love statement about Jesus. When we do Peter a bit after the break, Peter puts in there a whole section that's not in Mark. Doesn't make it right or wrong. It's a different painting. You know, you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build. So it's because it all goes back in Matthew's gospel. It all goes back. The leadership of Peter, which was a fact in the early church, there's no doubt about it, no one doubts that. Some Christian communities don't see that leadership was handed on to anybody, and that's a point of view that should be respected. It's not mine or probably not yours. So there's that difference in the churches. We're struggling with that issue, but nobody doubts Peter was so clear from the New Testament was the leader of the community. So where does all this leadership go back to? Why was Peter the rock on which the church was built, etc.? Matthew sees it all going back to this first love commitment of Peter to Jesus. So he puts it in there. Whereas John, you'll remember, basically puts it in the appendix in chapter 21, right after the resurrection. They're not arguing with each other. They're artists trying to communicate as powerfully as they can in a way that will connect the truths of who Jesus really is. There's a lot I have to leave out. I'll come to Mark chapter 9, verse 33. They came to Capernaum, and when Jesus was in the house, he was asking, what were you arguing about on the way? They were silent, which was a good way to be. A bit embarrassed, I'd say. For on the way, they'd argued with one another, who was the greatest? Here's Peter, just said, you're the Christ, and they've been with him for 2 years and they still haven't got anywhere near getting it. They're arguing about who's the greatest. I mean, that is such childish stuff. But I've got to examine my conscience and you have to examine yours, and I wonder if ambition does play a bit of a role in our life, or position or power or respect, I don't know what. Why are we doing what we're doing? Well, it's worth examining our conscience on it, because there's probably a degree of fault in there. But this is so blooming obvious. But this is probably encouraging to the people in Rome who thought they were hopeless. And they think, God, the disciples, we're not as bad as that mob. So he sat down with the 12 and he says to them, whoever wants to be first among you must be the last of all and the servant of all. And this is the word diakonos, first appearing in the gospel. It becomes a technical term in the whole New Testament, post-New Testament period for service, which is at the heart of Christianity. We get a word deacon from it, obviously. Now, the verb has occurred twice already, diakoneo, so you've got a connection there. The angels ministered to Jesus in chapter 1, verse 13, though we didn't attend to that text, when, you know, in the desert after the baptism. And we hear the first one to do any ministering in the New Testament is Simon's mother-in-law, when she ministered to Jesus. The healing, she was able to minister. So there's a lot of reflection got to go on in there for us. Mark 10. As he was setting out on the way was a very early word for the Christianity, the Acts of the Apostles. It's called the way, which is pretty typical of religions, but it's Christianity as well, because it is a journey we're on. A man ran up and knelt before Jesus and was asking him, "Good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" He's seen something in Jesus. He's got a lot, we're going to find out in a minute, but he hasn't got this, and he wants it. He's attracted to it the way you are attracted and I am, or we wouldn't be here. So he's attracted to something about Jesus and the disciples. That's beautiful. So he says, well, what have I got to do to be part of what you, obviously, you people really have? The whole world would love this if they realised it. And Jesus said, look, first of all, slow down. What are you calling me good for? Only God is good. So Jesus is the pointer to the mystery, the pointer to God. So having said that, he tells him, you know the commandments, and he runs through them all, and we know them, we won't read them. And the beautiful young man says, teacher, I've kept all these since my youth. And here's another little reason why I think it's the early tradition is right about Peter being behind the Gospel of Mark. I've only given you this example and one other I will, but it's throughout. Jesus looked at him attentively. The look of Jesus would have meant a lot to Peter, and you find it often in Mark's Gospel, Jesus' look. And back to, I think I said it maybe yesterday, Teresa of Avila says, look at him, she says, he's always looking at you. So this is the look of God, the look of... So he looks at this man and loved him. It's the first time we've met the word love. Whoops. First time we've met the word love. Here. Yeah. And said, you lack one thing. Get rid of all this clutter that you've got in your life. You know, give it to the poor. There's plenty of people need it. So, you know, like, just unclutter your life, and then you'll have treasure in heaven. Then you come along and join us. Jesus had to make a bit of a calculation because he wanted 12 apostles. This would make 13. They don't muck things up. But anyhow, he's adaptable, and you've got to be adaptable, so whatever. So he's come and follow me, and this really sad ending. The young man was shocked, and he went away sad, grieving, for he had many possessions. And that's very relevant to my life, and I'm sure it's to you. Your life mightn't be, mine isn't anyhow, with monetary possessions. But they're the least problematic. What about knowledge? What about the other things that you've been given, that I've been given in our life that keep us out off the street and lift us up a bit socially and economically even and in society? Like, we've been given so much. So anything, when God calls you or me to him, the question is, what do I need to let go to respond to love? You don't let it go first. You hang on to everything you've got. But when love calls you, if you find that there's something, if I find there's something stopping me respond to love, that's the thing I've got to... What a tragedy that would be. And life will show it. It'll be there if we're attentive. And this poor man went away because he had many possessions. I hope he came back the next day, and maybe he did. And now, the last scene before Jesus goes to Jerusalem. It's wonderful. It's a beautiful scene. The Gospels are very wonderful literature. They came to Jericho, and he and his disciples and a large crowd were leaving Jericho. Bartimaeus, and in case you don't know Aramaic, Mark translates it into Greek, that is the son of Timaeus, is a blind beggar, was sitting by the roadside. When he heard, so he's not even on the road, he shouldn't have been there because they cleaned the whole place up because Jesus was coming and he's got a bit of a reputation and they wanted to show themselves off and they probably had elections like they're having in Oregon. And they wanted to kind of clean things up and make everything look nice. And then they'd forgotten to clean up this blooming beggar because he was so much part of the furniture. And there he was, upsetting the tidy little show. So there he is, blind, begging, and off the road. Can you see yourself in that? When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout out and say, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." I don't know what he said. He probably said, "Hey, you," or something, you know. But it doesn't matter. We got it here in a very formal way. "Have mercy on me." Now, the others thought, "Oh, my God." They sternly ordered him to be quiet. Like, "Shut up, we're trying to..." But he cried out all the more loudly, "Son of David, have mercy on me." Jesus stood still and said, "Call him here." Jesus didn't go to him because, in a way, Jesus can't. He can only go if you go. He can only sit by the well if you sit by the well. Because he died. He's in heaven. He's beyond this empirical world of touch and sight and movement and that. So if Jesus is going to come, he's got to come like those four men who carried the man who was paralyzed. "You've got to do it. I have no hands but yours," he says. "I've got no heart but yours." So he inspires you to go, and therefore he goes. Jesus stood, "So call him here." And they called the blind man. They said to him, "Take heart," here it is again, courage. "Get up, he's calling you." So throwing off his cloak, has that got something to do with his blindness? I'm not sure. He sprang up and came to Jesus. And this is really lovely, and I'm sure you're all good at this. But not everyone's good at it. Sometimes I've knocked on a presbytery door and the person there, they don't know who the heck I am and I don't care that they don't know. That's okay, you could do it. You knock on the door and the person there, I said, "Oh," they say, "have you ever heard yourself say this? Oh, what can I do to help you?" It's a very nice thing to say in a way, but it's not too nice because maybe the person's come to help you. I mean, why are we always the ones giving the help? Why are we the ones with something to give? Jesus doesn't say, "Oh, he's a blind bloke. You'd like some sight, mate, would you? Here, have it." He says, "What do you want me to do for you?" He asks the question. He asks the Aboriginal person, "What can we do? What do you want of us? You tell us." Because he doesn't presume it's sight. The bloke mightn't want to be seeing. He might want something else. So he's very sensitive, beautifully, as God is with you and me. "What do you want me to do for you?" And the blind man said to him, "My teacher," this is great, "let me see again." So he saw once. This is the last scene of the journey of Jesus to Jerusalem. So it's got to be important. And that blind man is a Peter and Andrew and James and John and Mary and Joanna and Salome and everybody you want to name. It's you and me. It's every disciple. We've come right to the rest of Jerusalem, but we're still blind. We saw at Caesarea Philippi and then we forgot. You saw it in the novitiate and then you forgot. You saw it when you took your final vows and then you forgot. Do you know what I mean? I'm not having a go at you lot. I'm talking about myself and presuming you understand. But I mean, we do. We see and then we don't see. We have a retreat and we get an insight and then it goes because we don't nurture it or whatever. So he's saying, "I want to see again. The disciple wants to see again." Well, Jesus says, "Go. Your faith," here it is again, "has made you well." And immediately he regained his sight This is wonderful. And he followed Jesus on the way. Well, he's following Jesus to death and resurrection, to Jerusalem. Then there's a scene in Jerusalem, a few scenes, which I will not do for you for obvious reasons, but I want to come to the very last scene before the eschatological discourse and the Passion, which were, the eschatological discourse is about history and its meaning, I won't do it with you, and the Passion and resurrection of Jesus was all pre-gospel. It's the core gospel. So this is the very last bit that Mark adds in his introduction to the Passion and Resurrection, and it's wonderful, and it's about what is the essence of being a disciple. So, and if you're a painter, and you, I'm not, but if you say you were, and some of you probably are, or a musician or something, well, the last note that you play better be important, otherwise you'd go and spoil the whole thing with the last little muck-up. Or you're painting something and it's all looking lovely and then there's suddenly a black bit appears over in the right-hand corner that mucks up the whole thing. So, this is the last bit he puts in. It's going to be good. Jesus sat down opposite the treasury. He watched the crowd putting money into the treasury because Herod was building the temple still. Many rich people put in large sums. A poor widow. Widow, so she's got no husband and no son, no male to give her protection, money, whatever, anything. She's a very vulnerable woman. She comes and put in 2 cent pieces, 2 little lepta, the tiniest little, or in, that's in Greek, in the Latin it's quadrans. They're the tiniest coin. They're kind of useless. Like 2 cent pieces. So she puts in these 2 copper coins, the equivalent of 2 cent pieces. And Jesus can't resist it. And he says to his disciples, like, who gave the most? And they don't know who. They get it all mucked up. And he says, truly I tell you, this poor widow put in more than all who are contributing to the treasury. They put in what they had over. That's good. Doesn't knock them. She, out of her poverty, put in everything she had, all she had to live on. So I'll go back to my parish priest role, and those of you who are parish priests can do this, and every sister here in your own life. This, who gives the most to the parish? Who, now, there's some people who've got so many gifts and they're on the council and they're looking after the RCIA program and you thank them and they're wonderful people. But the person who's actually giving most to your parish, I don't know who the person is, but it's the person who's giving everything. It might be a person who's mentally deficient and not really able to do much, can't read or, you know, shy and awkward and... but they're giving love and they're giving prayer. They're actually the key to the whole parish. And what a stupid thing it would be to give them the impression you didn't need them. Oh, it's all right, darling, we don't need your gift. That's very nice. Thanks for coming. You know, so here's Jesus. And you'd never guess that. The apostles didn't get it. But the person who's giving the most is the person who's giving all she had to live on. And it might be nearly nothing. It all almost useless, but wonderful gift of love. So we come now to the last few moments of the life of Jesus. The Last Supper I won't delay on, but I'll just read it for you and remind you of what we did a bit earlier. While they were eating, taking a loaf of bread and blessing, Jesus broke it, gave it to them and said, take, this is my body. Body is a bit of a difficult word really in English. Soma in the New Testament, we're not too sure what it even meant because we're mixing. It wasn't a Hebrew concept, so it's not part of the Jewish tradition. They were very practical. They could just name things you could see, but thinking of body and soul was not part of their mentality. They weren't abstract thinkers. Then you're into the Greek world by this time, where they are abstract thinkers and they've got all kinds of ideas, and the soul can mean one thing to Aristotle, another thing to Plato, another thing to the Middle Platonists. It's all over the ship, and probably another thing to you and me, and probably subject is a better word than soul now, but anyhow, persons. So the best translation of body, I think, is person. This is me. I'm giving myself to you when I give you this bread. And that's our faith. Taking a cup and giving thanks, he gave it to them and they drank from it. He said, "This is my blood of the covenant. It's poured out for many," yes. I think we should say in English something like "the multitude," because many sounds like not everybody, doesn't it? And that's not what it means in Aramaic. So that's not what Jesus is saying. We've got to get careful about it. And perhaps it means, many means not a few, not a little elite, not a little kind of little tidy little group. It's for, I think, "the multitude" would have been a bit better translation of it. It's kind of boom, but it's free. You mightn't all get it. You mightn't all take it. But it's for the multitude. It's for the world, actually. For all. It's quite a reasonable translation of it in our English language. But we won't get into that, or I'll get too upset and I'll be weeping and so will you. "Truly I tell you, I'll never again eat the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new in the kingdom of God." So Jesus at the Last Supper was remembered. It's kind of giving his meaning for tomorrow, which we'll do now, the crucifixion. What it meant was the gift of Jesus to God and the gift of Jesus to us. And so when we do what Jesus did, wash each other's feet, John says, give ourselves in love, give our body to others, our person, our life, our agenda, our spirit, our love, when we give that to others, Jesus will pour himself into us so that it's there, like the miracle of the loaves, tomorrow. It's all there fresh. It's all there fresh every moment, really, for us to give. Even though we think we've got hardly anything to give, we've only got 2 cent pieces to give. Give it, because that's the most beautiful gift. A scene you're familiar with, but I do need to do it with you a bit. They went to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to them, "Sit here while I pray." And he took with him Peter and James and John. They were the ones at the Transfiguration. They were the ones that Jairus' daughter raised up. So there's something quite special going on here. And he began to be distressed and agitated. Well, they're probably all right translation, but it's a very strong Greek word. It was like a breakdown. It was like an overwhelming sense of something, which I'll talk about with you in a minute. And he needed people to be with him. "Stay here," he says. "Like, I need you. Keep awake." And going a little further, he threw himself on the ground and he prayed, "If it were possible, the hour might pass from me." He said, "Father, everything's possible for you. Take this cup away." Cup, you know, got a drink. "Yet, well, I want to do your will, not mine." And he comes and finds them sleeping, and you know the rest of it. This is a key sentence that can easily lead to terrible misunderstandings, I think. "Not what I want, but what you want." I was taught, but I had a very great advantage as a young man, and now I'm different, you can tell that. I was told I was quite scatterbrained as a young boy. And I thank God for it every day, because what it meant was that I was taught a lot of stuff, and if I didn't understand it, it went over my head. Whereas there are people around who are very alert and attentive and take it all in and get buggered up by it. Do you know what I mean? So I'm pretty sure I was taught that God planned the crucifixion of Jesus to save us. And what Jesus is saying here is, "God, I don't want to die, but you want me to die, so I'll do your will." QED? Fine. Except that it's a bit odd. I think the very thing Jesus knew, and now I'm guessing, because all I can offer you is a guess. I'm not teaching you Catholic theology, but anyhow, it's the best I can do, try to handle it. I think what Jesus is doing is he's sensing an immense failure. He hasn't done God's will. He wanted to, But the Pharisees are the same, the Sadducees are the same, the high priest is the same. What's changed after Jesus' 3 years? The disciples aren't ready, clearly. The crowd is as fickle as it ever was. They've come into Jerusalem, yah, 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 blah, blah, blah. And on Good Friday, crucify him, crucify him. You know, it's all a bit iffy. So I can't imagine Jesus at the agony thinking that I've failed, like I've let you down. So is Jesus saying, is this the conclusion of Jesus' prayer? Father, I don't know what to do. I don't want to die yet. It's not working. It looks like I'm going to, because he can see the vultures gathering and Judas and all this. So he's not stupid, isn't he? So he can see things are getting, it's getting tight. And so he's saying to God, but I know what to do now, he says. I will do your will, meaning I'll continue to love, I'll continue to embrace lepers, I'll continue to challenge the religious authorities, I'll continue to embrace people, I'll continue to speak of your love, whatever time I've got, I don't know how long, who knows what Pilate might do tomorrow, or the high priest, they could all be converted, and they might have been, because they're free. So Jesus, however, is right come to a climax of his life. But he knows something that I've got to know and you've got to know. He knows to do the will of God, which doesn't mean die. It means give your life. You got it? Give your life. Like the widow. Give all you've got. Give in love. And so he courageously does that. And we watch him now. That's what he's doing from here till the end. Tragically, the high priest didn't get it. Some of the council must have, because Joseph of Arimathea was somewhere in there and Nicodemus was somewhere in there. So they're not all crooks. Some of the crowd got it. They went away beating their breasts. Some of the soldiers even got it, we'll see. So there are different people. There's enough of them getting it to account for us being here this morning, 2,000 years later. So the Christian thing is a stunning thing. So, and why did people get it? Because of the scene that we conclude with. It was noon. Darkness came over the whole land till mid-afternoon. At mid-afternoon, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, another Aramaic phrase, Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani. It's quite close to the Hebrew, but not identical. And he translates it for us in Greek, and here's the English, my God, why have you forsaken me? Now this bit is a bit, I'm only guessing again, not guessing, I'm trying to do literary criticism, but it's iffy. When some of the disciples heard that, they were saying, he's calling on Elijah. Well, why would they think he was calling on Elijah? And this is my offering to you as a possibility only. These words are the first words, my God, why have you forsaken me, of Psalm 22:1. So clearly, Mark is telling you, Peter is telling you, go and read Psalm 22, and you'll get the closest you can get in our poetry to what was going on the cross. And if you do it, you'll see it does. It's just wonderful. It doesn't all apply to Jesus, but it's a beautiful poem of pain rising up to thanksgiving and gratitude and love. So, but it happens that the verse 10 of Psalm 22, which maybe this is what Jesus actually said from the cross. He may have said, Eli Atta, which in Aramaic means, my God, you. My God, you. And that's from Psalm 22. And hence he gives us Psalm 22 verse 1 to go and read. Because when you're dying of a crucifixion, you can't give a whole sentence. Your lungs are collapsing. So, my God, you. He recognises God in an ecstasy of love. Well, it so happens, however, that Elijah come is Eliyata. Elijah come. Well, can you hear the difference between Eliyata and Eliyata? It depends where you break the word. Maybe, just a maybe. Maybe that's what he cried. And because he said this, it sounded like Elijah come. Hence the Elijah bit that's thrown in there. Anyhow, someone ran up with a sponge, put it on a stick, gave it to him to drink, and said, wait, we'll see if Elijah comes down. And then Jesus gave a loud cry and breathed his last. Then comes an extraordinary little one line. And this surely will, if there's any fundamentalists in the room, this will kill you dead. You ready? You're about to be freed from any temptation. Because it says, the temple curtain was rent. Okay, all you fact people. So Jesus is on the cross dying. It's an incredible moment. And then Mark tells you, 100 yards down the road, God said, well, I'm going to get back on them. And he gets somebody to rip the curtain. And the women's sodality the next day think, oh my God, what are we going to do? They have to knit the whole thing up again. What are they talking about? Well, we should know what they're talking about because on the feast of Yom Kippur, the one day of the year, the high priest dared to enter behind the curtain. Everyone coming to the temple was coming to see the face of God, but you couldn't see the face of God. It's an analogy, of course, because the curtain is there. Only the high priest was allowed in once a year of Yom Kippur. Surely what Mark is telling us is that if you look at Jesus, John says it quite explicitly, look upon the one you've pierced. If you look at Jesus on the cross and watch how he died, which will come in a minute, if you do that, the curtain is gone now. There's no curtain hiding the face of God. Everybody can see the face of God by looking at the face of Jesus on the cross. That's what the curtain is about. It's that curtain that's rent. The curtain hiding God's face from us. Everyone is entering into the sanctuary. Everyone is baptized, priest, prophet, and king, you know. Everybody, every Christian. So, and then, lovely, the centurion who stood facing him, the outsider, the Gentile, the Roman centurion. We're talking about Rome. There's something. This is for the whole world now. It's not just the bystander was presumably a Jew, but this is a Gentile. And look, he says, he saw how he died. Not that he died. That he died doesn't save anybody. One more death, one more barbarous act of the Roman authorities, or that bloody film by Mel Gibson that was wonderful about the Roman torture and hopeless about God. Missed the whole point of it. So anyhow, you got all this, Jesus died so we're saved. No. Jesus, it's the way he died. The way he died.
The way he died.
It's how he died. He died in obedience, in love, in the gift of self. The Last Supper brings that out. The gift of himself to God and the gift of himself to us. That gift is there to be embraced if we have faith. We're not saved automatically. It's not that it has to be us welcoming it. Now to conclude, there's nothing about the resurrection in Mark except this bit. This is the end of Mark's gospel. It's lovely. It might even be the best end of any of them. But anyhow, this is what it is, and I hope it doesn't disappoint you. Because it's really good. You know, remember the women go to the tomb. Don't be alarmed, says the angel, the mysterious divine presence. You're looking for Jesus of Nazareth who was crucified. He's been raised. He's not here. Look, here's the place they laid him. But you, this is the point, you go, tell his disciples and Peter that he's going ahead of you to Galilee. There you'll see him. We haven't read it, but in the Last Supper, that's what Jesus said. That's wonderful. So I don't know where you're going on Friday, but when you go ahead on Friday, you're going to find when you open the front door, there's Jesus waiting for you, wherever it is. Kenya. Go to Kenya, and there he is. Go to wherever you live, Taiwan. You know, you're all over the place, you lot. Malaysia. So go there, America, for God's sake. Go there. He will be there waiting for you. Like God's answer to Moses, I am who I am, or better, I will be who I will be. Don't name me. I'll be there. You'll find me. Journey in love, in self-giving. Do this in memory of me, etc. And you will find I'll be there for you. And that's the end. Going out, they fled from the tomb. Terror and amazement had seized them. And they said nothing to anybody. They were afraid. Curtain, end of the gospel. No accounts of any revelation, of just a trust, a faith, a truth of what's going to be there for us as we journey. Thank you.